Welcome to the Ogletree Deacons Podcast, a brief discussion of compelling legal issues and practical insights. Please note that the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be, nor should it be construed as legal advice. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or through your favorite podcast service. Please consider rating and reviewing so that we may continue to provide the content that covers your needs. Please enjoy the program.
Hello, and welcome to This is Labor in California, a podcast from Ogletree Deacons, where we bring you a monthly overview of traditional labor issues in California, along with how employers may be handling those issues. I'm Maria Anastas, based in our Los Angeles office, and today I'm joined by my colleague Daniel Adlong in Orange County. So we thought we would switch up the format a little bit today and divide up between the two of us the top three things that we anticipate more of in terms of labor activity in 2021. A lot has happened so far, both at the national level, but also here in California. We feel pretty strongly that unions are geared up to engage in more activity. So we're just going to go back and forth and give you sort of our top three, you know, development, sort of forecasting what we think you may be seeing in 2021. So I'm going to let Daniel, why don't you go ahead first and shoot off your first one?
All right, Maria, thanks. For me, number one, much to my chagrin, is I think mail ballots are here to stay and they're going to be here for a long while. Just to give you an example, we're working on a petition right now in Northern California where the board agent is just coming out and saying specifically the regional director has not approved a manual election in over a year, and they're trying to use it as a bludgeon to get you to agree to a mail ballot election. I also know that in at least one of the Southern California regions, the regional director has basically a standing order that they will not approve mail ballots. I think the biggest problem this shows for us is that if you want to contest and even have an attempt at a manual election, you have to go to hearing or at least have a stipulated record with brief. And it really affects the timing and knowing at what pace to communicate with employees as you're dealing with an organizing drive, which presents an obstacle. And the other thing that's really problematic is you really can't rely on the mail anymore. And I'm hearing horror story after horror story about colleagues who have elections and the time to receive ballots are being extended, or ballots that are clearly being mailed but are never arriving on time. So I think it just kind of presents a new dynamic when you're dealing with organizing and trying to communicate with employees and make sure you get maximized voter turnout. And then the final part of it is if you're cooperative with the regions, I just had, and this wasn't in California, but I had a region asking me to waive all my objections regarding the mail ballot, which isn't something that you really should do, but if you don't keep a close eye on it, it's something that could get slipped in and you can have a problem in the future.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't know when, if ever, we're going to see manual elections again, which is obviously very disappointing. So at the top of my list is what I think we're going to see a lot more of, and that's an increase in virtual organizing. And, you know, during the pandemic, unions, you know, were somewhat hampered in accessing employees, especially in healthcare, for example, in a long-term care setting. They really have had difficulty reaching employees in that sort of traditional way. I think we've seen more web-based outreach, and I think we're going to see a lot more of that. And in particular, union authorization cards, you know, obtaining signatures, electronic signatures to establish their showing of support. I don't know if you remember back in 2015 when the NLRB's general counsel first said that electronic signatures were going to be acceptable. And there didn't seem to be much of an increase in the number of petitions that were supported by electronic signatures back then. But I think that could change. But so that's sort of the traditional aspect of, you know, what could change with respect to organizing. But I think also these alt unions or alt labor organizations that have an online presence, and they're popping up, more and more are popping up, it seems like, with, you know, a lot more frequency. Very interesting models. We could spend an entire podcast on this virtual organizing piece. But I want to identify one in particular. It's called getfrank.com. And it's a platform for, you know, worker voice to build power so that employees can get together and, you know, create what the website calls a meaningful change in their workplace. So I think, you know, these online campaigns and these new tools that are popping up to help workers organize is an interesting development that we should probably, we will likely see more of.
That's interesting you say that, because I've certainly seen, as we've addressed kind of employee discontent or just what is going on at different businesses that we're working with, you certainly are seeing use of more electronic means of Zoom meetings and FaceTime to connect with the employees. And it certainly presents just a new avenue to be exploited and to connect with the employees.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I actually forgot to mention that I've actually experienced very recently that type of organizing strategy, getting everybody on a Zoom. And there's so many other platforms today. So very accurate. How about your next one?
My number two, I think it's, I'll call it the return of the micro units. When I'm looking at kind of things to expect, I think organized labor is going to try to take a look at what they expect to come from the new board and take that path. If you look in California, we have 21 petitions year to date from January 1 to February 27. 13 of those units are smaller than 25. Presents a particular problem because you can create so much solidarity in those groups where employees, that if they had some openness, they'd be able to communicate with management and, you know, maybe figure out that there's a better way than bringing in a third party. But with such small groups, it creates a very tight knit that people receive a lot of pressure to kind of walk away from, and it makes it difficult to communicate. So I think I look at that as something that it needs to be addressed. If you have businesses, you want to make sure your frontline supervisors are wrapping their arms around their employees and making sure that they're building relationships so that you don't have small groups of employees that are discontented and then going out seeking union representation only for a small group of them.
So my second one is an increase in what we call these solidarity unions. They're not necessarily going to be certified by the National Labor Relations Board as the legal representative of the employees, but it's just a way for workers to mobilize and ultimately try to exert some pressure on their employers. So they're not union campaigns. They're issue-based campaigns. And I think we saw a lot of that in 2019 and 2020. I think we're going to see a lot more of these types of solidarity unions as an alternative to the traditional labor union. Again, another site to just, you know, check out if you have any interest. Coworker.org is another one of these, you know, solidarity type organizations. It helps employees build power. There's another one that's fairly new. It's called unitworkers.com. And it, again, gets the workers mobilized, helps them sign cards and form an independent union. And then unitworkers.com, which is actually a for-profit organization, provides, I guess, some sort of labor consulting services. So there's a lot of these organizations that are popping up. And I, you know, for a workplace that wouldn't traditionally have a union, whether it's because of the education level of the workers or for any other reason, these alternatives have had some great appeal in the last year or two. And I think we can expect to see more of that.
Yeah, as I hear you talk about your number two, Maria, it's kind of interesting because it kind of sounds to me like ours are complementary. I'm talking about, you know, maybe organizing smaller groups that you can actually have a legitimate unit out of. And you're talking about just smaller solidarity groups that might not necessarily be a unit appropriate under the act, but certainly that doesn't mean they can't band together and create pressure to achieve some sort of goal that they're seeking at the workplace.
And that sort of blends into my third, but I'm going to let you go next. Why don't you do your third and then I'll do mine.
My third, unfortunately, is going to go away from those two. But again, as I've looked at it, and, you know, if there's any sort of loosening of what's permissible in intermittent strike activity out in from DC as things are starting to wind their way through legislation. I think in California, because of, you know, what we talked about last podcast with respect to the Moscone Act and kind of the lawfulness of picketing, it starts to create a specific harm to California employers in light of our already loose and like sympathetic statutes regarding strikes and picketing. It just creates leverage for businesses who might otherwise have been able to like take a strike. But if they have clients or customers that really can't handle pressure from labor, it creates a different dynamic, and it could just bring to bear a new pressure on employers that are trying to do right by their employees and trying to do their best while a labor organization finds ways to put pressure on them and force them to kind of like bow to their demands.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about my third and final, and that is my perception that organizing triggers are different today, which is not to say that the traditional organizing triggers have disappeared. But in 2020, for example, we experienced, you did, I did, others in our firm did as well, that, you know, due to the pandemic, safety became a fairly common way for unions to organize workers. And prior to the pandemic, and I've been doing this a very long time, I don't recall ever having a campaign that was triggered by some type of safety issue. Now, I'm sure there were plenty of campaigns triggered by safety issues over the last 10, 20 years. In my experience, it wasn't a very common trigger of organizing. Obviously, with the pandemic, things have changed. But I think for 2021 and beyond, not only is safety still going to be something very important to workers due to the fact that we're still in this pandemic, but new issues, including things like the company's ethics and equity and transparency and workers wanting more of more input in the decisions that their companies make. So those types of issues, especially with the Gen Z and younger workers in general, I think we're going to see a lot more of those types of concerns creating the right atmosphere, maybe not for a traditional organizing drive, but for some of these other, you know, alt movements, whether they're, you know, part of these organizations that I've talked about, or whether they're just, you know, like an internal union at that particular company. So that's kind of one of the things that I think we're going to see more of in 2021 and beyond.
I think those are good points. I can say, like, I can think of at least two recent organizing drives one that I know of and another that I've worked very heavily in. The trigger was kind of what you're talking about. It might have been a little bit different. And sometimes I think it might not be the safety or the equity that you're talking about, but it could be that the workers bring it up and then it's not addressed in the way that the worker expects. And it turns into kind of being driven by this new issue, but it's kind of one thing that we're familiar with that, you know, my supervisors don't listen or management doesn't care about what I think and stuff. So it really does present a new dynamic with what you're talking about, needing to be able to not only address the issue, these new issues that are coming up, but also making sure that employees are feel like they're being heard as they bring up new topics that, you know, weren't the biggest concern, let's say, in the past.
I think there's just a greater awareness now, or at least that's what I'm feeling or seeing, I should say, with the cases that I handle. There's just a greater awareness of Section 7 rights, both with respect to, again, traditional union activity, but also just, you know, protected concerted activity. And I've seen from clients that we have assisted very recently that, you know, their employees are far more sophisticated these days and they understand what they can and cannot do. And so it's really just so important to make sure that your managers and supervisors have the appropriate training so that they don't step in it, so to speak. You know, we've kind of hit some, you know, hot topics. There's probably a lot that you know, our clients and other employers are thinking about, I would imagine, as a result of hearing at least what we think they can expect to see in 2021. And I think it really does underscore the importance of conducting those vulnerability assessments and making sure that you don't have the type of exposure that could put you in a very difficult position with respect to either unions or any of these other types of movements.
Yeah, I certainly agree with you, Maria, on that. I think, you know, one of the things is just making sure that frontline managers and supervisors feel that they're able to communicate and connect with the employees and maybe, you know, their superiors, making sure that frontline managers and supervisors have the training and tools to really engage employees and help employees feel successful at their jobs and also connect with them on a personal level so they feel like they have somebody there that they can turn to and they have legitimate relationships with.
I agree. And I think the last thing that I would say is I've encountered over the years, and I think it's particularly important today, you know, sometimes employers will think that they are immune from organizing, not so much because everything is so perfect in the work environment, because there is no such thing as a perfect work environment, but because of the nature of what they do, the type of organization it is, or the type of business, you know, or the type of employees that they have. And there is, you know, I think we've seen, especially in the last year or two, that that's just not going to be the case anymore. All types of workers, blue collar, white collar, whatever the color collar, are becoming more and more interested in unions and banding together to make sure that they have a voice in what goes on at work. So you are, if you have workers, you are not immune from union organizing. We've seen some very interesting organizing campaigns in the last year. I'm currently representing a client, and the employees in the bargaining unit are all lawyers, right? So another example of, you know, not the type of bargaining unit you would expect, but unions are also targeting nonprofits more and more. So whether it's lawyers or employees of a museum or any other type of nonprofit, you know, any employer is vulnerable.
I don't really think much needs to be added to that other than say, I think that's exactly correct. Like nobody should, you know, fall asleep at the wheel. Everybody's organizing is coming up. All different shapes and sizes.
Okay, well, thank you for joining today.
Thank you for joining us on the Ogletree Deacons podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts on Apple Podcasts or through your favorite podcast service. Please consider rating and reviewing so that we may continue to provide the content that covers your needs. And remember, the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be construed as legal advice.